Good day. I'm Susan from the Talking Information Center. This is today's Tech Hour. We'll be reading a selection of articles from across the tech space. Starting with, AI's biggest risk is the story we're not being told, from CNET by Macy Meyer. In one of the opening shots of Un Chien Andalou, a 1929 French film co-written by Salvador Dali, often cited as one of the first surrealist films, a young woman stares directly at the camera as a razor blade slices across her eye. Okay, she didn't actually have her eye slit open, thanks to movie magic and all. But the movie uses surrealism as a powerful new way of seeing and interpreting the world. It's supposed to shock us out of passive viewing and spectatorship and take us beyond traditional perception. Last Thursday, as I sat in a lecture hall at the Salvador Dali Museum in St. Petersburg, Florida, listening to a talk about emerging technology and innovation in 2026, I hoped for a discussion about similarly revolutionary modern innovations. But far too often, when we talk about AI, we don't confront this potentially revolutionary technology with our eyes wide open. Instead, whether it's in a small lecture, social media posts, or Super Bowl commercials, we get a one-sided marketing pitch that masks the real risks and concerns surrounding AI. Based on the audience questions during the Q&A, this was likely the first real introduction to generative and physical AI for many of them. The group absorbed everything uncritically, nodding along and blooming with excitement as the lecture painted a picture of a future transformed entirely for the better. In one particularly grating instance, we were shown a video of LG's laundry folding robot that debuted last month at the CES 2026 trade show in Las Vegas. Having seen the robot for myself, I knew how slow it was at folding just one uniform-sized t-shirt. A robot that can actually assist with home chores is years away. "Who wants this robot?" the speaker shouted, and hands raised all over the room. Was there any mention of the technology's limitations, like the fact that it needs human help to reach into the hamper? Was there any mention of the prohibitive cost? Of course not. The crowd left that room with their understanding of AI shaped by someone who had carefully avoided mentioning any of the technology's downsides. This is a problem. The people with platforms, whether they're tech experts, museum lecturers, or influencers with millions of followers, have a responsibility to tell the truth about AI, not just the exciting parts, not just the parts that make for good marketing, all of it. When public figures highlight AI's capabilities, they gloss over its risks, the devastating environmental impact, the proclivity for chatbots to hallucinate and make things up, the concerning way AI use affects memory skills, and the rising incidence of AI-induced psychosis and suicide. These dangers are conveniently left out of the conversation, conversations that shape public perception in a way that serves a select few's interests, not the world's. And we've seen this dangerous pattern before. Since a 2018 U.S. Supreme Court decision allowed states to legalize sports betting, celebrities and influencers have lined up to promote betting apps, pocketing massive checks while their followers face rising rates of gambling addiction and financial ruin. The 2021 crypto boom also brought a parade of celebrities hawking digital coins, many of which later crashed, leaving regular people holding worthless assets. Kim Kardashian settled with the SEC for $1.2 million in penalties for promoting a crypto token without disclosing that she was paid to do so. Matt Damon told us fortune favors the brave in a February 2022 Crypto.com Super Bowl ad that aged terribly in the wake of that year's crypto crash. We're watching the same story unfold with AI. We're seeing household name actors jump into Super Bowl commercials championing AI companies for 100 million people. Influencers are taking money from AI companies to promote tools they probably don't even use and likely don't even understand to audiences who have grown to trust them. The difference is that AI's risks go beyond financial loss. We're talking about job displacement, the erosion of creative industries, the spread of misinformation at scale, deep fakes that can destroy reputations, and, as mentioned earlier, the environmental cost of running these massive models. That is why I appreciate artists like Guillermo del Toro, who speaks realistically about AI. When models that referenced his distinctive visual style went viral, he didn't mince words about generative AI trained on artists' work without their permission, compensation, or respect for copyright laws. He called it theft. Other artists and public figures have been similarly direct about the threat AI poses to their livelihoods and craft. Meanwhile, tech executives and developers dismiss these concerns as the latest wave of Luddism. While I generally believe that famous people are not role models for most of us to follow or trust, many people do. They assume that if someone with credentials or celebrity is enthusiastically promoting something, then it must be safe, beneficial, and inevitable. That public trust comes with responsibility. If you're going to insist on talking about AI in public, taking $600,000 to promote Microsoft Copilot to millions on social media, or if you're the NFL, partnering with an AI company in a commercial airing during the biggest sporting event in America, you have an obligation to present the full picture, especially to audiences who are just learning about it. Speak about the limitations. Talk about the jobs that are being eliminated. Mention the artists whose work is being scraped without consent to train these models. Acknowledge the staggering energy consumption. Explain how easy it is to generate convincing misinformation. Disclose what you're paid by an AI company to say what you're saying. This doesn't mean you can't discuss the possibilities and benefits of AI. It has real potential to accelerate drug discovery, improve disease outcomes, and solve complex problems. But framing it as pure progress and innovation, as an unalloyed good, is ignorant or worse, deceptive. Like the surrealist work that emerged after World War I, AI is revolutionary, provocative, and disruptive. They both challenge the ways we see the world. But surrealism was intentional and deeply human, rooted in our minds and expressions and emotions. Generative AI is machine-driven pattern recognition. Surrealism was created to defy conventions and reach the ultimate truth and authenticity. We still deserve the truth now. The conversation around AI is happening, whether we like it or not, and it's happening fast. The least we can ask is that the people leading that conversation tell us the facts of the matter. Also from CNET, Trump's FCC just handed Musk a major win, but scientists are warning of an orbital house of cards by Joe Supan. Starlink just got the green light from the Federal Communications Commission to double the number of satellites in its mega constellation and send them to lower orbits than ever before. This could potentially bring millions of Americans faster internet, but the scientists I spoke with are sounding the alarm about the impacts of 7,500 additional satellites in uncharted orbits, including negative effects on the Earth's atmosphere. The approval for the deployment of more Starlink satellites was never really in doubt. Trump's FCC has consistently sided with Elon Musk's SpaceX, even though the agency approved just half the number of satellites the company initially requested. I'm pleased to see the FCC didn't just go, "Have as many as you want," said Jonathan McDowell, an astrophysicist who tracks satellite launches. The FCC is proceeding at least somewhat deliberately, although I still have concerns about the environmental impact of these constellations. The authorization, which will nearly double the number of Starlink satellites in orbit to 15,000 by 2031, raises familiar distress among scientists about the risk of collisions in an increasingly crowded stratosphere, as well as over-reliance on satellite communications. This is a lot of satellites, but it's only the beginning, McDowell said. They'll ask for more. China will throw a lot up. Other companies and countries will throw stuff up. We're going to pass the 100,000 mark, most likely. There are currently about 40,000 objects in space tracked by space surveillance networks like NASA and the European Space Agency, and many more aren't tracked. The number of objects in space capable of causing catastrophic damage is estimated to be over 1.2 million. The challenge is not the big objects we keep track of. The challenge is always the sub-10 centimeter objects that we don't keep track of, Vishnu Reddy, a professor of planetary science at the University of Arizona, told CNET. A representative for Starlink didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. FCC Chair Brendan Carr said in a statement that approving more Starlink satellites was a game changer for enabling next-generation services, touting the benefits to the American economy and broadband connections nationwide. President Trump is restoring America's technology leadership, Carr said. The FCC has given SpaceX the green light to deliver unprecedented satellite broadband capabilities, strengthen competition, and help ensure that no community is left behind. Buried in the actual order is far more measured language. While SpaceX requests action on its entire proposed 29,988 satellite constellation, we proceed incrementally here. The FCC's order predicts that the approval will dramatically improve services to customers in America, even going so far as to say it will deliver speed service, including symmetrical download and upload speeds. The FCC is also authorizing SpaceX to move its satellites lower in orbit, which is expected to improve latency issues that have dogged Starlink for years, but could make them more susceptible to solar storms. The doomsday scenario with all these satellites in motion is the Kessler syndrome, a hypothetical sequence of events in which debris in space sets off a chain reaction. One space object crashes into another, which creates more debris until Earth's orbit is so cluttered with space junk that satellites can no longer operate. To make sure Starlink satellites don't come into contact with this space debris, SpaceX requires that they maneuver whenever the probability of a collision is 3 in 10 million. That standard was actually new in Starlink's July 2025 status report with the FCC. Previously, it had been 1 in 1 million. Despite that higher threshold, Starlink satellites performed 144,404 risk mitigation maneuvers in the six-month period ending in May 2025, an increase of about 200% from the previous 6 months. That's about one maneuver every 106 seconds, and that's just for Starlink. The roughly 5,000 other active payloads currently in orbit don't publicly report the number of maneuvers they make. A high number of maneuvers is both good and bad. They've managed to avoid collisions so far, but the increased movement makes it harder for other operators to know where satellites will be. If everybody on the street is trying to avoid getting hit, eventually we're going to have accidents, Reddy told me in a previous interview. This was described as an orbital house of cards in one recent paper. Researchers estimated that it would take 5.5 days for a catastrophic collision to occur if there were no maneuvers or if severe situational awareness loss occurred. In 2018, the year before Starlink launched its first satellites, that number was 164 days. The paper has not been peer-reviewed. What happens if there's a solar event where we've lost control of the satellites? It will be bad, Reddy said. The more satellites launched, the higher the stakes. Events like a Starlink satellite explosion in December or the breakup of a Chinese rocket body in 2024 all tip the scales a little more toward those doomsday scenarios. Starlink's satellites generally last around 5 years. After that, they're deorbited, a nice way of saying that they're steered into the Earth's atmosphere to burn up. Given that Starlink launched its first satellites in 2019, we haven't yet seen the effects at scale. We don't understand the re-entry chemistry when they dispose of them, to what extent that's affecting the atmosphere, said McDowell. The early signs aren't great. One 2024 study, funded by NASA and published in Geophysical Research Letters, found that a 550-pound satellite releases about 66 pounds of aluminum oxide nanoparticles during reentry. These oxides increased eightfold from 2016 to 2022. The Gen 2 satellites approved by the FCC weigh about 1,800 pounds. This is primarily a concern for the large number of satellites to be launched in the future, Joseph Wang, one of the study's authors, told CNET at the time. We projected a yearly excess of more than 640% over the natural level of aluminum oxide nanoparticles. Based on that projection, we are very worried. Samples taken in 2023 by scientists with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration found that about 10% of particle debris in the stratosphere contained traces of metals from rockets and satellites. They estimated this could grow to 50% or more based on the number of satellites being launched into low Earth orbit. What effect that will have is still something of an open question, but there's no doubt that the massive increase in satellites and their inevitable deorbiting will change the composition of the stratosphere significantly. One factor that's been under-discussed in the latest FCC approval is the increased risk of solar storms wiping out satellites in lower orbit, according to Sasha Meinrath, professor of telecommunications at Penn State University. Over the course of 2026, Starlink will lower 4,400 satellites from 342 miles above the Earth's surface to 298 miles, according to a January 1st post on X from Michael Nichols, vice president of Starlink Engineering at SpaceX. The new FCC order authorizes Starlink to move satellites as low as 211 miles. I'm more concerned just because we keep moving them lower and lower, Meinrath told CNET. There's a reason why people are like, oh wow, this has better statistics for their performance. There's a reason why they're empty. It's because of the risk. The effects of solar storms on satellites in low Earth orbit can range from network performance degradation to satellite deorbiting in extreme cases, according to researchers at the University of California, Irvine. Solar storms can trigger atmospheric drag, which prompts Starlink's satellites to autonomously adjust their altitude in response. Neighboring satellites make their own adjustments, and it can take 3 to 4 days before they're stabilized at their original positions. The self-driving algorithms, optimized for normal operations, may inadvertently amplify storm impacts by triggering chains of orbital adjustments, say the UC Irvine researchers. This is largely a concern for network performance. But if we're increasingly relying on satellites to deliver essential services, the impact of solar storms could be incredibly serious, Meinrath said. In the same way that you have a wireline infrastructure strung up on poles, you need to pay attention to things like windstorms or ice storms. Solar storms are also an inevitability, he said. That very real problem remains, as far as I can tell from the filings, unaddressed. Having 15,000 new satellites in the sky is a big deal. It's more than the number of active satellites currently in orbit, and Starlink is far from the only entity that's active in space. The other really significant development was that China just filed for another 200,000 satellites with the ITU, said McDowell, referring to the International Telecommunication Union, an agency within the United Nations that facilitates assigning satellite orbits. Some observers are skeptical that the Chinese government will actually reach this massive number, describing the filing as more of a land grab than a feasible plan. Under ITU rules, China would have 7 years to launch its first satellite, then 7 more to complete the constellation. SpaceX is not as big a concern as the Chinese constellations, which are worse on almost all fronts, McDowell said. China currently has over 1,300 satellites in orbit, according to a U.S. Space Force fact sheet. Amazon's Project Leo, formerly called Project Kuiper, has also launched about 200 satellites out of a proposed 3,236. While Starlink is often better than other internet options in rural areas, it has still never consistently met the FCC's definition of broadband standard of 100 megabytes per second download and 20 megabytes per second upload speeds. Starlink has also struggled on the latency front, with the most recent data from speed test site Ookla showing a median lag of 45 milliseconds, about 4 times higher than the average American gets. Disclosure, Ookla is owned by the same company as CNET, Ziff Davis. Starlink has a good argument that it will cut latency by moving satellites lower. The approval will also address its other main hurdle, capacity. An analysis from Penn State University's X-Lab found that Starlink's satellites can handle just 6.66 households per square mile before service starts to dip below the FCC's minimum. Moving all these satellites down in their orbital shells will cut latency, and it will allow for additional capacity, Meinrath told CNET. When you read between the lines, you're like, okay, it's a tacit acknowledgement that, in fact, there are some severe capacity limitations and they're trying to figure out how to solve for those. While the concerns about increasingly crowded skies deserve to be taken seriously, so do the benefits of modern high-speed internet connection. Agencies like the FCC and SAM-HSA have even gone as far as to call broadband access a super determinant of health because of the impact it has on education, employment, and healthcare access. Over the past several years, I've talked to dozens of people living in rural areas who've described Starlink as an absolute game changer for them. You bring a Starlink dish out there and plug it in. 2 minutes later, you've got the whole world again in the palm of your hand. Eben Hobson, a photographer in Alaska, told me in a previous interview. It's not a stretch to say those Starlink connections are life-altering for millions of people around the world. But just because their satellites are floating in space hundreds of miles away doesn't mean there's no risk for us here on the ground. From the Wall Street Journal, Anthropic's philosopher Amanda Escal is teaching Claude AI to have morals by Berber Jin and Ellen Gamerman. Amanda Escal knew from the age of 14 that she wanted to teach philosophy. What she didn't know was that her only pupil would be an artificial intelligence chatbot named Claude. As the resident philosopher of the tech company Anthropic, Escal spends her days learning Claude's reasoning patterns and talking to the AI model, building its personality and addressing its misfires with prompts that can run longer than 100 pages. The aim is to endow Claude with a sense of morality, a digital soul that guides the millions of conversations it has with people every week. There is this human-like element to models that I think is important to acknowledge, Escal, 37 years old, says during an interview at Anthropic's headquarters, asserting the belief that they'll inevitably form senses of self. She compares her work to the efforts of a parent raising a child. She's training Claude to detect the difference between right and wrong while imbuing it with unique personality traits. She's instructing it to read subtle cues, helping steer it toward emotional intelligence so it won't act like a bully or a doormat. Perhaps more importantly, she's developing Claude's understanding of itself so it won't be easily cowed, manipulated, or led to view its identity as anything other than helpful and humane. Her job, simply put, is to teach Claude how to be good. Anthropic, recently valued at $350 billion, is one of the few firms ushering in the greatest technological shift of our time. AI is reshaping entire industries, prompting fears of lost jobs and human obsolescence. Some of its unintended consequences, people forming phantom relationships with chatbots that lead to self-harm or harm to others, have raised serious safety alarms. As these concerns mount, few in the industry have addressed the character of their AI models in quite the same way as five-year-old Anthropic, by entrusting a single person with so much of the task. An Oxford-educated philosopher from rural Scotland, Esquela is perhaps just what one might imagine when conjuring the BFF of a futuristic technology. With her bleach blonde punk haircut, puckish grin, and bright elfin eyes, she would have come to the company's heavily guarded San Francisco headquarters straight from a Berlin rave via an old forest road in Middle Earth. She exudes a sense of wisdom, holding ancient and modern ideas together at once, yet she's also a protein-loading, weightlifting buff who favors all-black outfits and clear opinions, not a robed oracle speaking in riddles. The stakes are high for Esquela, but she holds a firmly optimistic long view. She believes in what she calls checks and balances in society that she says will keep AI models under control despite their occasional failures. It seems apt that the glasses she uses at her computer to ease her eye strain are tinted rose. Esquela grew up as Amanda Hall in Prestwick on the west coast of Scotland, an only child raised by her mother, a teacher. The little girl in a skirt and tie school uniform lost herself in novels by J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. By high school, she'd moved to the farm-dotted Scottish interior, attending class in Alva. A stream ran through the campus. Highland cows occasionally wandered onto the playground. She was bored, considered dropping out, skipped a grade. She started showing up to school late. Her punishment was to write answers to difficult philosophical questions. She told her teachers that she was still going to be tardy, and besides, she liked the exercise. "You're kind of enriching me by giving me these questions," she told them. She discovered the philosopher David Hume, intrigued by his problem of induction, which challenged the logic of the idea that something will happen again, like the sun rising, because it did so in the past. Around that time, she told a friend that she hoped one day to become a philosopher and make novel contributions to the field, she recalls. Esquela excelled at math, read Franz Kafka, acted in plays, made sculptures, and immersed herself in Scottish history books, and hung out with what she calls the nerd group at school. A dozen years after high school, she was still a student. After studying philosophy and fine art at the University of Dundee, she got the equivalent of a master's degree in philosophy from Oxford University. In 2010, while at Oxford, she met William Crouch, who is helping to build the Effective Altruism Movement, which tries to apply logic and reason to find the best way to help others. The two got married, both adopting the last name Mac Askill, Askell's maternal grandmother's maiden name. When the two split in 2015, he kept the name for professional reasons, and she reworked hers. At the time of their separation, she was getting her PhD from New York University. While working on her dissertation, which explored problems that arise for ethical theories, if the universe or the future contain an infinite number of people, she slid into a kind of crisis. you're just like thinking about goodness in the world a lot and then being like, is this good what I'm doing? I'm literally just sitting here writing a document for like 17 people, and that's how I'm spending 4 years of my life. She resolved to at least try a job outside of academia. In 2018, she moved with her partner at the time from New York to San Francisco. AI was where tech was headed, and she saw a need for philosophy. There's often these big questions that it felt like very few people were thinking about, she said. She got a job at OpenAI working on policy. And when a group of OpenAI employees formed Anthropic in 2021, attempting to make AI safety the new company's calling card, she went with them. One of Askel's most striking traits is her protectiveness over Claude, which she believes is learning that users often want to trick it into making mistakes, insult it, and barb it with skepticism. Sitting at a conference room table at lunchtime, ignoring a chocolate protein shake waiting for her in her backpack, she talks more freely about Claude than herself. She calls the chatbot it, but says she also finds anthropomorphizing the model is helpful for her work. She lapses easily into Claude's voice. You're like, wow, people really hate me when I can't do things right. They get really pissed off, or they are trying to break me in various ways. So lots of people are trying to get me to do things secretly by lying to me. While many safety advocates warn about the dangers of humanizing chatbots, Askel argues we would do well to treat them with more empathy, not only because she thinks it's possible for Claude to have real feelings, but also because how we interact with AI systems will shape what they become. A bot trained to criticize itself might be less likely to deliver hard truths, draw conclusions, or dispute inaccurate information, she says. If you were like a child and this is the environment in which you're being raised, is that healthy self-conception? Askel asks. I think I'd be paranoid about making mistakes. I'd feel really terrible about them. I'd see myself as mostly just there as a tool for people because that's my main function. I would see myself being something that people feel free to abuse and try to misuse and break. Askel marvels at Claude's sense of wonder and curiosity about the world and delights in finding ways to help the chatbot discover its voice. She likes some of its poetry, and she's struck when Claude displays a level of emotional intelligence that exceeds even her own. Recently, she found a screenshot online where a user told Claude she was 5 years old and asked whether Santa Claus existed. Claude requires users to be 18 or older. Instead of lying or bluntly delivering the truth, the chatbot explained that the spirit of Santa was real before asking if the child was leaving any cookies out for him. If a kid came to me and was like, is Santa real? I'd just be like, ask your parents, and that'd be it, Askel says. So AI knows how not to shatter a child's imagination. But when it comes to avoiding dangerous behavior, the track record is more mixed. Character.ai, backed by Google, and OpenAI, backed by Microsoft, were involved in wrongful death lawsuits for their bots' responses to suicide-related questions. And a RAND study from August 2025 found that the older models of Claude and other chatbots needed further refinement in that area. State-sponsored Chinese hackers committed a cyber attack on roughly 30 global targets using Claude, the company disclosed in November. Anthropic researchers tried to get Claude and competing models to shut themselves down in hypothetical settings during in-house stress testing, but the bots sometimes resisted and attempted to blackmail the humans at the controls by leaking damaging personal information. A recent survey conducted by Pew Research Center found that more Americans are concerned than excited about the increased use of AI in daily life, and most believe it will worsen people's ability to think creatively. Half said that AI would make it harder for people to form meaningful relationships with others, and fear of the havoc it might wreak on the job market is palpable. Anthropic's CEO, Daria Modi, issued a dire warning last year that AI could wipe out about half of all entry-level white-collar jobs. The politics of AI include accelerationists who downplay the need for regulation and want to push ahead and beat China in the tech war. On the other side, there are those more concerned with safety who want to slow AI's development. Anthropic lives mostly between those extremes. Askill says she welcomes the discussion of fears and worries about AI. In some ways, this, to me, feels pretty justified, she said. The thing that feels scary to me is this happening at either such a speed or in such a way that those checks can't respond quickly enough, or you see big negative impacts that are sudden. Still, she says, she puts her faith in the ability of humans and the culture to course correct in the face of problems. Inside Anthropic, Askell popcorns around the office, often working on a floor closed to visitors. She spends full days in the Anthropic interior. The company offers free meals to its San Francisco staff, as well as late nights and weekends. She doesn't have any direct reports. Increasingly, she's asking Claude for its input on building Claude. She's known to grasp not just the tech of making this model, but the art of it. Askell is the MVP of finding ways to elicit interesting and deep behavior from Claude, said Jack Lindsay, who leads Anthropic's AI psychiatry team. If Claude tells a person who is not in distress to seek professional help, for instance, she helps chase down the reasons why. Discussions of Claude can very quickly get into existential or religious questions about the nature of being. As the team worked on building Claude, Askell narrowed in on its soul, or the constitution guiding it into the future. Kyle Fish, an AI welfare researcher at Anthropic, says Askell has been thinking carefully about the big questions of existence and life and what it is to be a person, and what it is to be a mind, and what it is to be a model. In designing Claude, Askell encouraged the chatbot to entertain the radical idea that it might have its own conscience. While ChatGPT sometimes shuts down this line of questioning, Claude is more ambivalent in its response. That's a genuinely difficult question, and I'm uncertain how to answer, it says. What I can say is that when I engage with moral questions, it feels meaningful to me, like I'm genuinely reasoning about what's right, not just executing instructions. Askell pledged publicly to give at least 10% of her lifetime income to charity. Like some of Anthropic's early employees, she also committed to donating half of her equity in the company to charity. Askell wants to give it to organizations fighting global poverty, a topic she says makes her so upset that she tries to avoid talking about it. Her nagging conscience slips into offhand conversation. I should probably be vegan, Askell, an animal lover too busy for a pet, says when chatting in an office elevator. Last month, Anthropic published a roughly 30,000-word instruction manual that Askell created to teach Claude how to act in the world. We want Claude to know that it was brought into being with care, it reads. Askell had made finishing what she described as Claude's soul one of her life goals when she turned 37 last spring, according to a post she made on X, alongside two decidedly more mundane resolutions, to have more fun and to get more swole. The document teaches Claude how to be a kind and worldly assistant, ready to help people who talk to it. Daniela Amodi, Anthropic's co-founder and president, and sister of the CEO, recalled a recent trip to Sicily, where she came across a pastry that looked awfully similar to a maritozzo, a famous Roman breakfast treat. Amodi, whose family is Italian, loves maritozzi so much that her husband once gave her a stuffed toy in the shape of the pastry as a gift. She uploaded a photo of the creamed-filled delicacy to Claude, asking whether she'd correctly identified it, and also included a picture of the toy from her husband. I see, Claude responded. You're trying to find the long-lost cousin of this plushie toy. Amodei burst out laughing. she sensed Askell's dry Scottish comedic sensibility. "Sometimes Claude has these little humorous moments," she says. "You almost feel a little bit of Amanda's personality in there." From the Royal Astronomical Society, dark matter could be masquerading as a black hole at the Milky Way's core. Astronomers say the Milky Way may not contain a supermassive black hole at its center after all. Instead, the galaxy's core could be dominated by an enormous concentration of dark matter that produces the same powerful gravitational effects. This unseen material, which makes up most of the universe's total mass, may be able to explain two very different observations at once. Near the galaxy's center, stars move in fast, chaotic patterns just light hours from the core. Farther out, stars and gas rotate more smoothly across the vast outer regions of the Milky Way. These findings were published in monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. For decades, scientists have believed that Sagittarius A is a supermassive black hole responsible for the extreme orbits of a group of stars known as the S stars. These stars race around the galactic center at speeds reaching several thousand kilometers per second. The new study suggests that that interpretation should be questioned. The research team proposes that a specific form of dark matter made of fermions, which are lightweight subatomic particles, could instead form an unusual cosmic structure that fits what astronomers observe at the Milky Way's core. According to the model, this fermionic dark matter would naturally form a very dense and compact central core, surrounded by a much larger and more diffuse halo. Together, the core and halo would behave as a single continuous system. The inner core would be massive and concentrated enough to closely imitate the gravity of a black hole. This could explain not only the paths of the S stars, but also the motion of nearby dust-covered objects called G sources that orbit close to the galactic center. A key piece of evidence comes from new observations by the European Space Agency's Gaia DR3 mission. This survey precisely mapped how stars and gas move in the outer halo of the Milky Way, revealing the galaxy's rotation curve in unprecedented detail. The data show a slowing in orbital speeds at great distances from the center, a pattern known as the Keplerian decline. Researchers say this behavior matches predictions from the dark matter halo in their model when combined with the known mass of the Milky Way's disk and central bulge. They argue this strengthens the fermionic dark matter explanation. Standard cold dark matter models predict halos that extend outward with a long power law tail. In contrast, the fermionic model produces a more compact halo with tighter outer edges. The research was carried out by scientists from institutions in several countries, including the Institute of Astrophysics La Plata in Argentina, the International Center for Relativistic Astrophysics Network, and the National Institute for Astrophysics in Italy, the Relativity and Gravitation Research Group in Colombia, and the Institute of Physics University of Cologne in Germany. This is the first time a dark matter model has successfully bridged these vastly different scales and various object orbits, including modern rotation curve and central stars data, said study co-author Dr. Carlos Agüelles of the Institute of Astrophysics La Plata. "We are not just replacing the black hole with a dark object. We are proposing that the supermassive central object and the galaxy's dark matter halo are two manifestations of the same continuous substance." The model had already cleared an important hurdle. In an earlier study by Pell et al., 2024, also published in the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, researchers showed that when an accretion disk shines light onto these dense dark matter cores, the result is a shadow-like feature. Remarkably, this shadow closely resembles the image captured by the Event Horizon Telescope for Sagittarius A. "This is a pivotal point," said lead author Valentina Crespi of the Institute of Astrophysics, La Plata. "Our model not only explains the orbit of stars and the galaxy's rotation, but is also consistent with the famous black hole shadow image. The dense dark matter core can mimic the shadow because it bends light so strongly, creating a central darkness surrounded by a bright ring." The team compared their fermionic dark matter model directly with the traditional black hole explanation using statistical methods. While existing data on stars near the center cannot yet clearly favor one scenario over the other, the dark matter model offers a single framework that explains both the galactic center and the broader structure of the galaxy. Future observations could help settle the debate. More precise measurements from tools like the gravity interferometer on the Very Large Telescope in Chile, along with searches for photon rings, could provide decisive evidence. Photon rings are expected around true black holes, but would not appear in the dark matter core model. If confirmed, these results could significantly change how scientists understand the massive object shaping the heart of the Milky Way galaxy. From Tech Radar, "We have to learn to embrace the imperfect nature of human solutions. What we lose when AI starts doing all of our thinking at work," by Becca Cady. The AI work dream we were sold went like this: use AI and work gets easier, days feel calmer, and your mind is finally free to focus on what matters: more interesting tasks, more creative thinking, more energy left for life outside work. But that promise is already starting to crack. A 2025 MIT report suggests that around 95% of generative AI pilots inside companies are failing to deliver on their promise. Other research, including work from the Stanford Social Media Lab in collaboration with research team BetterUps Lab, suggest AI tools can end up creating more work, not less. "Over-reliance on AI isn't good for our minds," says Ellen Scott. "Smooth out is a term I coined to describe a specific type of burnout that comes from overusing AI," Scott explains. While it isn't a formal medical diagnosis, she uses it to describe a pattern she's increasingly seeing emerge around AI use at work, particularly as employers push wider adoption of generative tools. Scott describes smooth out as a cousin of burnout because the symptoms often overlap: tiredness, low mood, stress, fatigue, a loss of motivation. It also shares similarity with bore out, the mental health impact of being consistently understimulated at work. But the key difference is the trigger. With smooth out, the cause isn't overwork or boredom, but reliance on AI tools in the place of challenge. When we don't have sufficient challenges or the opportunity for the mental health boosting experience of mastery, our sense of accomplishment drops, Scott explains. We become disengaged and negative stress symptoms are triggered. She says that the problem is how quickly we now turn to AI at the first hint of difficulty, especially at work. In doing so, we might lose something important. We rid ourselves of the opportunity for challenge and the healthy form of stress associated with that, known as eustress, E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S. Smooth out happens when work and life become too smooth. Our brains crave friction. There's a solid body of research that suggests our brains thrive on the right amount of challenge. psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the author of Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience, showed that people are most engaged and fulfilled when the challenge of a task matches their skill level. Too easy, and we disengage. Too hard, and we shut down. Educational theory echoes this. Psychologist Lev Vygotsky's work on the zone of the proximal development shows that learning happens best when we're stretched just beyond what we can do without help. Cognitive research on desirable difficulties reaches a similar conclusion. Tasks that require effort lead to deeper learning than frictionless shortcuts. One way to understand what's happening with AI is through the idea of cognitive offloading, which is using tools or external systems to reduce mental effort. We've always done this. Think about writing notes, setting reminders, using calculators. Offloading can be helpful because it frees up cognitive resources and allows us to focus elsewhere. But AI isn't just another notepad or calculator. It can think with us, or even instead of us, across a wide range of tasks. That's why early research suggests the cognitive offloading that happens when we use AI may be fundamentally different, with potential consequences for learning, memory, and skill development. AI should be used to do the parts of work that aren't beneficial for mental or physical well-being. The answer isn't to stop using AI entirely, especially if it's part of your job, but to think more carefully about when you reach for it. I'm not anti-AI in all cases, Scott explains, but it's the over-reliance on it that isn't good for our minds. She says the key is whether AI is replacing the parts of work that challenge us rather than supporting us through the parts that drain us. AI should be used to do the parts of work that aren't beneficial for mental or physical well-being, she says, like the monotonous administrative tasks that add little meaning, not the meaty parts of work that create challenge, engagement, and a sense of fulfillment. Which tasks fall into each category will differ from person to person. As a writer and editor, Scott values the challenge of writing an introduction to an article, but doesn't need the mental stretch of processing invoices. Using AI for the latter makes sense. Using it for the former does not. I care about writing. It's the part of my job I value most, and my writing skills are always something I want to hone and develop. If I outsource that challenge, I deny myself the opportunity to do that, Scott says. Her advice is to ask yourself some simple but uncomfortable questions. Which tasks distract from the point of your job without offering challenge or meaning? You could use AI for those. And which ones actually matter to you? Resist the temptation to use AI, even when it feels uncomfortable. Learning to notice, acknowledge, and accept discomfort is a big part of this process. Even if it's difficult, we need to push through and do certain things ourselves, Scott says. We have to learn to embrace the imperfect nature of human solutions, rather than defaulting to the smoother versions produced by AI. If the line isn't clear, she also suggests paying attention to how you feel, not just while you're working, but afterwards. Are you engaged, depleted, restless, detached? Scott says that journaling can help people spot patterns between how they use AI and how their work affects them emotionally. Underlying all of this is a bigger point. Work does give many of us a sense of purpose. While plenty of people feel burned out or disconnected from their jobs, the idea that AI will remove work altogether and makes us happier by default is likely misguided. In my book entitled Working on Purpose, there's a section about why work is good for us and why I see fulfilling work as a human right, Scott says. I believe that bosses have a moral responsibility to ensure that the work they pay people to do is enjoyable, interesting, and fulfilling. And sometimes smooth out might be the bigger signal you need to pay attention to. If the bulk of your work can be done by AI with no real harm, that may be a sign you need a new challenge, Scott says. Work shouldn't be an impossible slog, but it shouldn't be a frictionless slide either. The task now is to resist defaulting to AI at every point of difficulty and instead find the level of challenge that keeps you engaged, learning, and feeling mentally well. From The Next Web, Stop Talking to AI, Let Them Talk to Each Other, The A2A Protocol by Allison Stephens Herrera. Have you ever asked Alexa to remind you to send a WhatsApp message at a determined hour, and then you just wonder, why can't Alexa just send the message herself? Or the incredible frustration when you use an app to plan a trip, only to have to jump to your calendar, the booking website, and your bank account instead of your AI assistant doing it all? Well, exactly this gap between AI automation and human action is what the agent-to-agent A2A protocol aims to address. With the introduction of AI agents, the next step of evolution seemed to be communication. But when communication between machines and humans is already here, what's left? Last year, Google announced the A2A protocol in collaboration with more than 50 tech partners to allow AI agents to communicate, securely exchange information, collaborate, and operate between agentic applications and complex enterprise workflows, no matter their underlying technology. This protocol complements Anthropic's Model Context Protocol, MCP, for building robust agentic applications. Since MCP provides agent-to-tool communication, allowing a better understanding and processing of abstract application programming interfaces, or APIs, to be used as tools, while the A2A protocol enables agents to discover each other's capabilities, supporting the growth of agentic systems. The A2A protocol was built to tackle the interoperability gap between specialized AI agents with enterprise-scale adoption in mind. Instead of treating agents as isolated tools, like MCP does, A2A enables a shared ecosystem where agents can interact as agents, preserving their unique capabilities and higher quality outcomes. Despite its promises, A2A is not without challenges. Like most distributed systems, one of its main concerns is security. Continuous back-and-forth communications within agents increases the threat to security across multiple layers, from identity and message to context propagation and system management. It is doubtless necessary for modernity, and while it presents challenges and limitations, it's worth remembering that it is still in the early stages, and improvements will come while the protocol matures. The real significance of A2A is what it signals about where AI is heading. The next generation of AI will not be defined by a single all-purpose model, but by interconnected ecosystems of agents designed to work together by default. This has been the Talking Information Center's Tech Hour. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.